respondent is Dr. Charles Arend, chairman of the systematic theology department here on our campus.
I thank Dr. Brown for an engaging and stimulating paper this morning. Lutherans often tend to view the Reformation only from the perspective of Luther and Wittenberg, and so do not always see it from the standpoint of others. Thus, I found it helpful to have Dr. Brown give a view of Renaissance Europe as seen, for example, from the perspective of Pope Leo X. More substantively, however, Dr. Brown correctly highlighted the importance of unmasking the idolatry of our age, whether it is the idolatry of democracy or the idolatry of choice or the idolatry of the self-constituting individual. This accords very well with Luther's penetrating explanation of the first commandment in the Large Catechism. There he makes the point that faith determines the very core of our being. In other words, as creatures, as dependent and contingent beings, we must center our lives on someone or something. In other words, human beings cannot live without a God. The only question that remains is, where do we turn to find meaning, validation, or identity? So calling a thing what it is, as Dr. Brown did, certainly reflects Luther's theology of the cross, as it unmasks all theologies of glory. I wonder, though, whether it takes a Luther to draw attention to the idolatry of our age. Could we here have substituted for Luther's name a Francis of Assisi, a John Huss, a John Calvin, or a Martin Luther King Jr.? For Calvin himself, for example, referred to the human heart as a veritable factory of idols. More recently, well, 30 years ago, Ernest Becker, a cultural anthropologist, described humankind's tragic destiny as such that he must desperately justify himself as an object of primary value in the universe. He must stand out, be a hero, make the best possible contribution, the biggest possible contribution to world life, show that he counts more than anything or anyone else. What's true for individuals applies to societies. Becker writes, quote, "Every society thus is a religion, whether it thinks so or not. Soviet religion and Maoist religion are as truly religious as our scientific and consumer religion, no matter how much they may try to disguise themselves by omitting religious and spiritual ideals from their lives," unquote. I think Dr. Brown has done the same today. Unmasking the idols the human beings create for themselves in order to justify their existence or validate their lives is a vital task. But in the end, Luther's first and foremost concern was not Leo X or Iraq or even unmasking idols. As Dr. Brown mentioned, his first and foremost concern had to do with the proclamation of the gospel that we are completely and fully righteous in God's eyes on account of Jesus Christ. What is not readily recognized or sufficiently appreciated, however, is that the confession of justification addressed not only a question of salvation, but of anthropology, namely the nature, purpose, and definition of a human being. Thus, the Reformation grappled with such topics as original sin, the role of the human will, justification, sanctification, law, and gospel. Now, the ancient Greeks had used the discipline of philosophy to think about what it means to be a human being and how human beings should live within the world. In the 20th century, modern societies have increasingly drawn upon the more recent disciplines of psychology, sociology, anthropology, political science, economics, and sociobiology. As such, contemporary thinkers have come to see the human being as a machine, an animal, a sexual being, an economic being, a pawn of the universe, a free being, a social being, or a genetic product. Most people, however, presuppose certain understandings of what it means to be a human being without giving it much thought. We learn it from our parents, from the world around us. We hardly ever stop to think about the foundation on which our goals for life and our decisions rest. And yet, our attitudes and axioms or actions arise out of the axioms and principles that determine what we think a human being should be and do. Luther recognized it was not enough for human beings to study themselves. Yes, we can learn much from the various disciplines, but not everything. The results will always be incomplete. Because we are creatures, what it means to be fully human lies beyond the grasp of the human mind. For this reason, a theological perspective is needed if we are to comprehend the full mystery of what it means to be a human being and to grasp the foundation and purpose of our existence. Here, I think it's helpful to cast Luther's insights both into idolatry and the gospel into the larger framework of his thinking, namely, the two kinds of righteousness. So important was this framework that Luther refers to the two kinds of righteousness as our theology in his famous 1535 Galatians commentary. Now, I know to speak of two kinds of righteousness is a mouthful. I'm enough of an American to be sensitive to the importance of marketing and making things short enough that they can fit onto a ball cap. So if you prefer, we can talk about the 2KR. A former student actually made this for me. On the back, it says, "This is our theology," Luther's quote from the commentary. The two kinds of righteousness is simply another way to configure the Lutheran distinctions such as law and gospel or the two kingdoms. It stresses that God has made us as relational beings who live in the presence of God and at the same time in community with one another. To summarize it briefly, Luther confessed that God built a vertical bridge down to his human creatures in the incarnation and work of Jesus Christ. Luther's insight to the gospel made it clear that the bridge between God and the world goes only in one direction, down. As my friend Mark Mattis put it, down into the depth of our sin and brokenness. In other words, our daily activities, religious or non-religious, do nothing to establish, reestablish, promote, preserve, or perfect our relationship with God. Before God, we live a receptive life. We experience a passive righteousness. But Luther saw at the same time that the counterpart to such passiveness before God is an active, energetic engagement with the world. In other words, Luther's Reformation contribution lay not only in rediscovering our passive righteousness before God, it consisted equally as much in his recognition that the one who clothed him in the righteousness of Christ is the same one who created him for life in this world. A point that I don't think has always been sufficiently appreciated over the years. Moreover, Luther stressed that the two kinds of righteousness are not alternative forms of human existence. People need both in order to be completely and genuinely human. To be a human being as God created us involves being totally passive as a newborn child of God and totally active as a responsible neighbor to our other people and to the whole of God's world. Tension exists between these two dimensions of the human being in such a way that there's a perennial danger to collapse one into the other and think only in terms of one kind of righteousness, whereby humans lose what it means to be truly human. And this was Luther's diagnosis of what had gone on in the late Middle Ages. We need both the passive righteousness we have in Christ and the active righteousness that we have in the world. They serve different purposes. Today, our topic is that of lay vocation and Christian engagement in the world. Here's where we need to appropriate the less well-known thinking of Luther regarding the active righteousness of the Christian within the world. We've already talked, among other things, points related to this last evening. For example, one that no longer needing our works to curry favor with God, we use our works for the good of a neighbor. God doesn't need our works, our neighbor does. Or secondly, that we embrace life in this world as God's creation, thereby neither fleeing the world into Christian colonies nor finding the need to establish a theocracy or Christocracy on earth. Or third, that we do what lies at hand, even if our daily activities are not always glorious or glamorous, they're still the best things that we can do in life, for God has approved them. Or four, as we've talked about natural law, that we see the law in the sense as God's instruction guide for how his creation works. Or five, and I'd like to pick up on this, the reference last evening to the first article of Luther's Catechism that speaks of reason, imagination, as a good gift of God. A bit of a challenge, I think, for Lutherans who are accustomed to thinking of reason as bad. After all, in the third article, I cannot, by my own reason or strength, believe in Jesus Christ my Lord. Nevertheless, in the first article, reason and all the resources it provides, the disciplines it develops, reason mediates the law into our lives to serve our neighbor as we live out our vocation. As it does so, however, there will always be a certain amount of ambiguity in how we live out our lives within our callings. There will be a lack of clarity about how best to carry out our tasks and responsibilities. That is to say, there is not always a right or wrong way of doing things. And here I'm thinking, especially as Dr. Brown mentioned, in terms of recognizing things as policies. Instead, we are dealing with what might be called better or best. Just as there exists any number of ways by which I can cherish my wife, that is a given, or take care of my children, so too there may be several viable policies that may be developed and implemented for alleviating poverty or providing health care within a society. Thus, the results of the law reasons mediation of the law. In other words, I'm distinguished between that we do something and how we do it. That I cherish my spouse is a given. How we do it, there's a variety of ways. That I love my neighbor is a given. How do we do it? As a result, the results of reasons mediation of the law will take different forms from society to society, culture to culture, and even family to family. It will give rise to different political systems, different ways in which families function, different ways that individuals act. Since there is not always a right or wrong way, the options we choose are based upon deliberation and debate. In other words, we have to use our noggins to try and figure out what we are to do. Sloppy thinking does no one any good. But here there is always going to be a sense that our decisions are best guesses. We try to do what's best for our neighbor, what's best in a community, what's best for a society. This means that we do not have the luxury of idolizing what we do. Everything remains penultimate and tentative. As Timothy Wenger has pointed out, this means that Lutherans, even Luther, make mistakes, which is to be expected. We just can't worship them.